This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. I'm John Stauffer, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Isabel Wilkerson. I'll speak for about 5 or 6 minutes and then bring her out. I should say that I know Isabel because I reviewed her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, for the Wall Street Journal, and soon after met her. When I was reading her book for my review, I understood it just as I was reading it, how important, groundbreaking, and truly brilliant it was. I teach at Harvard. I teach American history and literature and write on the Civil War era and African Americans in particular. And I was not at all surprised how well the book had has done. It has remained a phenomenon since it was published in 2010, justly celebrated not only as a brilliant work of history, but as journalism and literature as well. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Linton History Prize, the Anisfield Wolf Book Award, the Heartland Award, the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and was a New York Times bestseller for well over a year. It was also named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times, USA Today, Oprah Magazine, Amazon, and Publishers Weekly. And it was named one of the best books of the year by The New Yorker, Washington Post, Economist, Boston Globe, San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Tribune, Entertainment Weekly, Philadelphia Inquirer, The Guardian, The Seattle Times, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the Christian Science Monitor. In other words, all of the major newspapers and magazines. It unites history, journalism, and literature in very unique ways. And so before turning the floor over to Isabel, I'd like to summarize how and why her book is so groundbreaking in each of these areas. It's not an exaggeration to say that before this book, the Great Migration was shockingly underappreciated. Most Americans knew little, if anything, about it, and the books devoted to it were, frankly, unimpressive. The Warmth of Other Suns essentially changed that. It captures for the first time the full achievement of the Great Migration, which spanned some 5 decades from World War I through the 1960s, when some 6 million blacks fled the former Confederate states seeking new lives in the South, or in the North. These blacks had been living as serfs since Reconstruction, tied to the land through debt peonage. In migrating, they asserted their right to freedom, thwarting whites' efforts to restrain them. As Wilkerson summarizes, it was the first mass act of independence by a people who were in bondage in this country for far longer than they have been free. The Great Migration was an above-ground railroad on a massive scale, and it transformed American culture. Before it began, 90% of blacks in this country lived in the South. By the time the mass movement ended in the 1960s, roughly half of American blacks resided in the North. It remade northern cities. It turned jazz, the blues, and Pentecostalism into national institutions. And it sparked the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, which would have been virtually impossible without the huge influx of new black constituents in northern politicians' black backyards. The Warmth of Other Suns combines breathtaking research with great narrative and literary power. And the result is a brilliant and deeply moving epic, the best book there is on the subject, and indeed, in my view, on American migrations of any kind. In my review for the Wall Street Journal, I said that Isabel Wilkerson does for the Great Migration what John Steinbeck did for the Okies in his fictional masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath. In many respects, however, Wilkerson's task was more difficult, for she was bounded by empirical evidence where Steinbeck could draw on imagination in writing his novel. I wish that more historians would look to literature as sources and models for how to write. She offers a model for how to write truly dazzling, brilliant narrative nonfiction. Wilkerson humanizes the history in ways that no historian has been able to do, giving her subjects rich emotional and psychological depth. Like Steinbeck, she is dazzling at capturing the experiential sense of her migrants' lives. No history better conveys the grueling repetition required to pick 100 pounds of cotton a day for 50 cents. Wilkerson gets inside of her protagonist's heads and gives her readers a penetrating sense of what it felt like to be part of the Great Migration. The Warmth of Other Suns also resembles The Grapes of Wrath in its structure. Steinbeck's focus is the Jode family, but he universalizes their plight with inner chapters that describe the parallel struggles of many other migrants. Wilkerson achieves a similar effect, but her structure is even more sophisticated and nuanced than Steinbeck's, for she had to cover 5 decades rather than 1, and migrations that went in 3 directions, northwest, north, and northeast. In essence, the Great Migration encompassed 3 separate migrations. In a forthcoming book on the great American novel, my colleague Larry Buell at Harvard appropriately includes a discussion of Wilkerson's book as an analog to Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath and John Dos Passos' USA. She is in good company as a book or as a person who wrote the great American, if not novel, then book. The Warmth of Other Suns is in part a collective biography of 3 migrants. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney, who left Chickasaw County, Mississippi with her husband for Chicago. George Swanson Starling, who fled Central Florida for Harlem to avoid being lynched. And Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, a surgeon from northern Louisiana, who drove 2,000 miles to Los Angeles following hyphens in the road that blurred together toward a faraway place, as Wilkerson lyrically writes. Like Steinbeck, Wilkerson's interchapters connect her protagonists' lives to the mass of migrants, and in the process, she makes major interventions in the scholarship on the Great Migration. Wilkerson's protagonists were neither leaders of the migration nor famous. Gladney, Starling, and Foster were ordinary men and women, representative of their class and region, their lives recovered through Wilkerson's extensive interviews. As Wilkerson emphasizes, the Great Migration was a leaderless revolution. There was no Moses or Joshua or Harriet Tubman, or for that matter, Malcolm X or Martin Luther King Jr. to organize the migration. Ordinary people listened to their hearts instead of their leaders. The North was no promised land, however. Higher wages were offset by staggering rents, and subtler forms of prejudice replaced the blatant segregation and lynchings that had enforced the power of Southern whites. Throughout her book, Wilkerson emphasizes that the migrants were determined and resilient. As a group, they were better educated and more resourceful than their Southern peers. Foster established a lucrative medical practice in Los Angeles, catering to the city's black population. And Gladney and Starling reached levels of economic and social stability that would have been impossible in the South. Wilkerson powerfully rebuts the stereotype of migrants corrupting Northern cities. All previous scholars have argued that many, if not most, migrants were illegitimate children or came from otherwise dysfunctional families, and that they brought unemployment and poverty with them. Wilkerson's book counters this near consensus, showing that migrants, despite having to adjust to their crowded and competitive new worlds, led more stable lives than blacks who were born in the North. Another achievement of the book is that Wilkerson is the first to connect migrants to other immigrant groups. Much like Irish or Italian immigrants, migrants built new lives around the people and churches they knew from back home. They took jobs others considered beneath them, and they tried to teach their children the religious values of the old country while urging them to succeed by the economic standards of their new world. In combining history with journalism and literary techniques, Wilkerson offers a more richly textured sense of the past than just about any other work of history. To this day, I know of no other work of history that matches the literary, journalistic, and historical power of The Warmth of Other Suns since it came out. Instead of invoking abstract concepts and historiographical questions, Wilkerson gives us a thick description of her subjects and their culture. She shows us why literariness matters in history and journalism. It adds cogency to the argument, humanity to the people, a sense of wonder and surprise to the past. The novelist Willa Cather, who also combined history and journalism with literature in novel ways, described the aim of narrative writing about the past this way. Whatever is felt upon the page without being specifically named there, that, one might say, is created. It is the inexplicable presence of the thing not named that gives high quality. Wilkerson creates a similar feeling upon the page. In her recent review of Ayanna Mathis's Northern Passage, a novel about the Great Migration, Wilkerson said in her review that there has been no novel like The Grapes of Wrath that looks squarely at this migration. Now, the review came out in the New York Times Book Review. It was a front page review. And when I read this quote from Isabel, I almost picked up the phone or emailed her to say, but Isabel, there is a novel like The Grapes of Wrath that looks squarely at the Great Migration. It's also a brilliant work of history and of journalism. It's your book. Please join me in welcoming Isabel Wilkerson.
Thank you. I'm just overcome with the emotion to hear hear Professor Stauffer, the person who wrote one of the earliest reviews of The Warmth of the Suns, and it was in the Wall Street Journal, and I can keenly remember running out to get as many copies of that paper as I could. And I opened it up and I read it, and I felt as if he had been somehow in the room as I was writing it, because he so truly captured what I was attempting to do with this book. It also means so much to me to be in this on the sacred soil of New Mexico. Thank you so much to everyone here at the Lannan Foundation for arranging all of this, for inviting me here. It means so much to me because at this precise time of the year, April, 60 years ago exactly, for those of you who've read the book, you'll know where I'm going with this, but 60 years ago to the month, 1953, April, was the time when one of the three protagonists, Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, began his drive from Louisiana, ultimately to get to California, and he came through New Mexico. Of course. How do you get there driving without getting through New Mexico? And so he did. He stopped along the southern route. He stopped in Lordsburg. And then he began a journey that got a little more complicated than he'd intended and anticipated. And that's where the story really begins to get a little more suspenseful. But I want to step back a little bit. And I want to talk a little bit about the journey that this whole book has taken me on. This is a copy of my book that I have had. I've been carrying it around with me since 2010 when the book first came out. You know, I spent 15 years researching and writing this book. The book looks like it's 15 years old. You know, I often say that if this book were a human being, it'd be in high school and dating. That's how long it took me to write this book. I didn't know it was going to take 15 years. I would never have set out to do anything for 15 years. And yet, I'm so glad I didn't know, because I don't know that I would have embarked upon it. And I can't imagine not having done this. So I'm so glad I didn't know. But I want to say a little bit about some of the things that I've learned along the way, what I've found to be really, truly what the book is about. I spent all this time working on it. I spent several years talking about this book, and now I feel as if I've now begun to really, truly understand what it's about. You know, the subtitle for the book is The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, so it would lead you to believe it's about migration, and of course it is. But what it really is about is the universal and human longing for freedom. It's really about freedom and how far people are willing to go, to what lengths people are willing to sacrifice in order to be free. And these people, by what they did, they become proxies for someone in almost all of our backgrounds who had to have done what the people in this book did just for us to be at this place, at this time, on this soil, because this truly is the story of, in some ways, how what human beings do when life becomes difficult and they think there's something farther away that might allow them to be who they are really truly intended to be. What's different about this, though, is that this particular migration is quite special in our country's history, and that is that this is the only time in our country's history, the only time that American citizens had been forced to or felt that they had no other option but to leave the land of their birth and set out for places far, far away within the borders of their own country, the borders of their own country, just to be recognized as the citizens to which they had been born. No other group of Americans has ever had to make that heartbreaking decision to leave in that manner within the borders of their own country. And so that's one of the things that makes us so very different. Another thing is that this was not a move in the way that people might be relocated by their company from Cleveland to San Diego. This was, in fact, a seeking of political asylum within the borders of one's own country. This was, in fact, a defection from a caste system that was so arcane and so unimaginable to many of us alive today that it was actually against the law in Birmingham for a black person and a white person merely to play checkers together. In Birmingham, you could go to prison if you were caught playing checkers with someone of a different race. It's as if someone must have seen a black person and a white person in some town square in Birmingham, and perhaps they were having too good of a time, and someone saw this and felt that the entire foundation of Southern civilization was in peril, and we cannot have this, and actually took the time to write this down as a law and to get this passed through the powers that be, the power structure in Birmingham, Alabama. This caste system that these people were living under was so arcane that in courtrooms throughout the South, believe it or not, there was actually a black Bible and an altogether separate white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in court. The very word of God in the minds of the people who had made this law, the very word of God was segregated. And I discovered this in a newspaper article that ran in the 1940s describing this. I saw the word, and the story was written not because this was a new law, not because there was any sense of alarm or excitement about this new law. In fact, the law had been in place for quite some time. This was 1940s. The only reason it made the papers that day was because on that particular day there was a trial in session, and that someone was about to take the witness stand, and they could not find the black Bible for this person who was about to take the stand. And so they had to disrupt the trial in order to be able to find the Bible. That meant that the sheriff's deputies, the court officers, the bailiff, all had to comb the courthouse in order to find this Bible for so this trial could be resumed. This is an example of how extreme and arcane and the dailiness, the daily sense of the nerve-jangling reality of living in a world in which every single step that you took, every decision you made, every single door you might open might be one that would lead to the breach of some arcane and invisible law that had been set about by this caste system. I've had the joy this book has taken me all over the country and even outside of the country, and I always find that wherever I happen to be, one of the most challenging audiences is always the high school students, bless their hearts, as they say in the South. And part of that is because they are so beautifully and delightfully removed from all that I'm describing that they have a really hard time imagining how and why people would do such a thing to other people who are basically neighbors living in the same county down the road. Why would people do such a thing? And they have a really hard time with this. And so I found myself trying to explain this in one particular case to a group of high school students in Hawaii. And I mention this because I think it's so instructive for all of us to remind ourselves of the extreme nature of the world that people are living under. And so I found myself having a difficult time getting through to them, and I decided I would come up with this one example that was out of the book. I thought of this example, and before telling you what this example was that got through to them, I'd like to see if I might get a show of hands. I can see shadow, but I think I might be able to see the hands if they do rise. I'd like to see if you might be willing to share with me whether you've done the following within the last 6 months. Now, what I'm about to ask you is not illegal. I would never ask that of anyone. I have a feeling that some people here in the audience may have done what I'm about to describe, but I'd like to see if you would be willing to admit to this. How many of you have found yourself driving your car and you found that you were about to overtake a car in front of you that was driving more slowly than you were, and so you did the wise and safe thing, which would be to pass that other motorist on the road? How many of you found yourself driving your car and you passed someone on the road? That's the question. Yes, most hands went up. I see a couple that didn't go up, and I would respectfully submit to you that you do not drive if your hand didn't go up, because it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to not pass someone on the road. In fact, you very likely did that on the way here. It's just so common. It's so common and ordinary, and in fact, the safe thing to do. Well, had you been African American throughout much of the 20th century, during the time that this caste system was most deeply in effect by law, from the time of Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, well into, in fact, the 1970s in some isolated precincts of the American South, believe it or not, it was against the law for a black motorist to pass a white motorist on the road, no matter how slowly that person was going. And I would submit that that could account for a couple million people being ready to leave right then and there, because that actually, it stretches the bounds of human patience and long suffering to avoid doing what is the right and safe thing to do. Well, when I mentioned that to the students in Hawaii, the high school students, that got their attention. In fact, they were so upset by what I had said that they began to talk among themselves, and I pretty much lost control of the classroom at that point. And there was this murmuring in the back of the room, and I asked these students, what was it that they were saying? And a student raised his hand, and he said, "Well, I would have honked." And I said, "Let me start again. Now, if you couldn't pass the people on the road, you couldn't honk to make them go faster either." And they weren't liking that answer either, and so they talked among themselves, and another raised his hand, and he said, "Well, I would have tailgated. I wouldn't have made any noise. I would have tailgated, though, to let them know they needed to move faster." And I said, "Well, now, if you couldn't pass the people on the road and you couldn't honk to make them go faster, you couldn't tailgate either. In other words, you had to stay in your place. That's what it means to be in a caste system, an artificial hierarchy that's been created to control the movements and the rights and the privileges of all the people there based upon, in this particular caste system, what the people look like. And so, therefore, you would have had to have stayed within your place, and you could not have tailgated either." And so at that point, another student raised his hand, and he said, Well, I would have left then. And I said, my sentiments exactly. That's what 6 million Americans, African Americans in the South, did as a part of this great migration, a form of defecting the caste system into which they had been born. This caste system, you know, it's humorous to hear how the students respond to this, but this was a life and death matter for people who were living in that world. This was a matter of great concern and fear, because in order to maintain something as artificial as that, it took a tremendous amount of violence to enforce something that was really, on some levels, unnatural. And that meant that every 4 days from 1889 until into the Depression, an African American was lynched every 4 days for some perceived breach of the caste system that I've described to you. And the more common reason for lynching was not the kinds of things that we often, the more spectacular cases such as Emmett Till's accusation of having made an untoward remark toward a white Southern woman, but instead for the more ordinary things. In other words, people lost their lives for the accusation of having stolen 75 cents. People lost their lives for the accusation of having stolen a hog. And the most common reason cited for lynching was the amorphous accusation of acting like a white person, which could mean any number of things. Not tipping one's hat quickly enough, not stepping off the sidewalk, walking into the wrong door, any number of things. And in fact, it seems as if the caste system relied upon the enforcement, the overreaction, obviously, to the smaller things, because if you punish people for the smaller things, then the larger things were not likely to happen. And so this was the world that the people were growing up in and living in. Now, I wanted to share with you, I've been asked to read, I wanted to share with you another aspect of what it was like to live in this caste system, and that was the mind-numbing work, the limiting kinds of things that people were forced to do, meaning that by being born into a caste system, you were born into a labor caste. In other words, you were born into a job. You were born into the world in which you would be working on a cotton plantation or sugar plantation, rice plantation, or rice field, all of the kinds of agricultural work. Or you would be teaching or preaching to those people who were doing that kind of work. Or you would be working in the homes of the planters. Those were the jobs of the lowest caste that these people had come from. And so this is an example of what that life was like. This is the story of Ida Mae Brandon Gladney, and it's just a short passage from the book that describes what it was like for her. Chickasaw County, Mississippi, 1929. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Ida Mae's new husband took her to live in a little wood cabin on Ed Pearson's plantation on a clearing past the Natchez Trace. Ida Mae was 16. In the morning, the sun poked at them through the gaps in the roof. At night, they could see the stars through the ceiling cracks over the bed. It just about rained inside as much as out. They set about working cotton for Mr. Ed. All around them, the land was in a state of being cotton or becoming cotton. Brown and rutted for planting, green shoots willed into rows of cottled bushes until the land was white out to the tree line. Every so often, a wood cabin broke the clearing raw and thrown together, built uneasily on a footprint of land that was a fraction of what was devoted to the field. The people who lived in the cabins gave the best hours of their days to cotton, working until the sun went behind the trees and they couldn't see their hands anymore. Early morning, the mist rose over the fields and made a halo over the surface of the earth. Ida Mae's new husband and the sharecroppers working other sections of Pearson's land tried to pick as much as they could before the sun got high. It was like picking 100 pounds of feathers. That was the gold standard of picking. The goal was to get the benchmark of 100 pounds a day of cotton. It was 100 pounds of lint dust. It was one of the most back-breaking forms of stoop labor ever known, wrote the historian Donald Holly. It took some 70 bowls to make a single pound of cotton, which meant Ida Mae would have to pick 7,000 bowls. 7,000 bowls to reach 100 pounds. It meant reaching past the branches into the cotton flower and pulling off a soft lock of cotton the size of a walnut out of its pod, doing this 7,000 times, and turning around and doing the same thing the next day and the day after that. Ida May had watched people do it all her life and knew how it was done, but when it came to actually go out and pick, she would look up and see everybody else far down the row. At weighing time, she would empty her sack on the scale and never get three digits. Above her was an entire economy she could not see, but which ruled her days and determined the contours of her life. There were bankers, planters, merchants, warehouse clerks, fertilizer wholesalers, seed sellers, plow makers, mule dealers, gin owners. A good crop and a high price made not much improvement to the material discomforts of Ida May's existence, but meant a planter's wife could begin to dream of a new parlor carpet and a piano, and a salesman of farm implements could be lavish with more expensive cigars than he smoked last year. On Wall Street, there were futures and commodities traders wagering on what the cotton she had yet to pick might go for next October. There were businessmen in Chicago needing Oxford shirts, socialites in New York and Philadelphia wanting lace curtains and organdy evening gowns. Closer to home, closer than one dared to contemplate, there were Klansmen needing their white cotton robes and hoods. This was the world that these people were living under. And none of this really truly changed in large numbers until World War I. And that's because during World War I, the North had a tremendous labor shortage. The caste system that I've described to you really came into effect in many respects because the South had relied on not just a supply of cheap labor, but an oversupply of cheap labor to do this mind-numbing work that I've just described to you. And so that meant that there needed to be more people there to do the bidding, to be at the will of the land when the land called for them. And that meant that the people needed to feel as if there was no option but to stay. And the only way to keep them there was to create a caste system that would keep them bound to this place almost as if they had been during slavery times. And so nothing really changed for them in large numbers. There had been a trickle of people who'd left before during the Underground Railroad, but the numbers did not swell until World War I, and that's because during World War I, it was the North that had a problem. The North had a problem because Europe was at war, and with Europe at war, that meant that immigration from Europe came to a virtual halt, and there the North was, dependent on immigrant labor from Europe, and many of the people who were there working the factories and the foundries and the steel mills of the North ended up having to lose that labor because many of the people were returning home to help with the war effort. And thus the North began to set out looking for the cheapest labor in the land, which meant African Americans in the South, many of whom were not being paid for their hard labor. They were working for the right to live on the land that they were farming, as Ida May was and her family. They were sharecroppers and they were not even being paid. And so that is how this migration began in such large numbers. The people who first arrived came at the express invitation of the North. They came at the express invitation of the North. Now, a couple of things I want to say about what this meant when they answered the call of the North. A couple of things is that the South did not take kindly to this poaching of its cheap labor. The South did everything it could to keep these people from going. They actually would arrest people from the railroad platforms when they had northbound tickets. They would actually arrest them from the train seats. And when there were too many people to arrest, they would wave the train through so that people who had been hoping and praying and saving up for this chance to get to what they perceived as freedom had to watch that train leave without them and then figure out how now will we get out. And for that reason, many of the people who ultimately left had to leave in the middle of the night. They had to sneak away, steal away, almost as if they were runaway slaves. And yet this occurred within the 20th century, within the lifespan of people, many, many people alive today. This went well into the 1960s, and therefore this is not ancient history, this is living history. And this is the history of what the people had gone through. Now, a couple of things to put this in perspective about what this means for all of us, and when we think about American history and what that means for all of us. This was the first time in American history that the lowest caste people in our country signaled that they had options in large numbers, signaled that they had options and were willing to take them. That had never happened in large numbers in the history of our country this many people, 500,000, half a million leaving just within the World War period alone, World War I period alone. This was the first time that the lowest caste people in our country actually had the chance to choose what they would do for a living and where they would live. If you think about it, you think about those cotton fields and those rice plantations and those tobacco fields and those sugar plantations. On those sugar plantations, on those cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields were actually opera singers, jazz musicians, playwrights, novelists, surgeons, architects, engineers, teachers, attorneys. And how do we know that? We know that because that is what they and many of their children and many of their grandchildren ultimately became once they had the chance to choose what they would do for a living and how they would live out their lives. That had not been a choice for people for African Americans throughout most of our country's history. This is a very new thing. It doesn't go back for many, many, many years. This is a very new thing that has occurred as a result of this great migration. Another thing that happened that I think is worth noting is the loss. If you think about the loss to our country of all of that talent and all of that genius and creativity that went unrecognized, unfulfilled for generations after generations after generations. When you think about those people who were doing what was assigned to them by the caste system in an arbitrary way based upon what they looked like. But also think about the loss on the other side. The loss on the other side of the people who had actually created the caste system to begin with, the putative beneficiaries of the caste system, they were losing as well. Maybe their loss was even greater on some level. And it's a loss to all of us in this country when you think about the loss on both sides. But the loss to the side of the people who were the architects of this caste system was a spiritual one. Because it took such a tremendous amount of effort to maintain this caste system, the artificial nature of it, that they spent an inordinate amount of effort and energy keeping these people down. And if you think about it, if you hold someone else down in a ditch, you have to get in the ditch with them. So this was a loss to our entire country to have this largest section, a region of our country, held back and focused in on a losing battle to hold down an entire group of people for so long. Now, the book is clearly a narrative. It's a story about people, the people who actually live this. It's intimate, it's family, it's universal, and it's human. And I want to just tell one short story out of this that's not directly related to the main protagonist, but it's a story that I think says so much about the meaning of all of this, and it connects us all. This is a way of picturing what was it like to actually be one of these people who was on the verge or trying to figure out what they were going to do. Should they go or should they stay? This is a question that someone in almost all of our backgrounds, just depending on how far back we go, had to have considered just for us to be here. And so in this particular case, this requires us to scroll back to the 1920s in Alabama. And in the 1920s in Alabama, there's this family that's referred to in the book. And it's a family of sharecroppers. And the family has 9 kids. And the youngest one is about 9 years old at the time that this discussion was going on among the family members. The 9-year-old son, the youngest one, they were quite worried about him because he was very small-boned, very weak, it seemed, very sickly, and they were constantly worried about what will become of him in this harsh world that we live in. How will he make it as a sharecropper going forward? What should we do? So they were constantly worried about him. Now, where they were living, these people were living in Alabama, and this migration, I should say, proceeded along beautifully predictable paths, so that wherever you were in the South, there was going to be a predictable path you were going to take to get to freedom, as you might have perceived it to be. And there were 3 different routes. One was up the East Coast from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia to Washington, D.C., and on up the coast to New York and beyond. There was the Midwest stream, which carried people from Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, and Arkansas to Chicago, to Cleveland, and the entire Midwest. And then there was the West Coast stream, this stream, which carried people primarily from Louisiana and Texas to out west, ultimately to California for many, and even for some, they went all the way to Alaska. And I met someone who went to Alaska. I was in Alaska in January. They greeted me by saying that they were so happy it was going to make it to zero that day. So this is really just not so bad here in Santa Fe right now. But in any case, because this family was in Alabama, thus the place that they had that everyone was talking about getting to freedom was a place called Cleveland. Cleveland was the place of freedom for people in that part of the South. Cleveland loomed so large in the hearts and the minds of the people at that time that this family actually named their youngest son Cleveland. That was his name. James Cleveland was his name. That's the name they gave him. Now, there was a debate between the mother and the father about what they should do. The mother was convinced that they should go. The father was not so certain, so they went. You know, it was running that family. Now, as they were preparing to leave, the father was so nervous and wondering what was he going to do, how were they going to make it. He heard that it got below 40 degrees up there in Cleveland, and there was something called snow, which they'd not seen before. He was wondering how was he going to take care of his family. He was worried and so nervous that he literally was shaking as he was preparing and packing to go. And this at this point that the little boy, James Cleveland, recognized how very serious this thing was. They get on the train. They make their way north. They make it to Cleveland. And on the little boy's first day of school, the teacher asks him what his name is. And he tells her his name, which is short for James Cleveland. He was known by the initials JC, which is what he told her. And she didn't understand his Alabama accent. And she, with her northern accent, began calling him Jesse instead. And that is how Jesse Owens got his name. His name was not Jesse, was never Jesse. His name was James, for the record. And yet, when he went home and told his parents about what had happened in school that day, he told them that the teacher started calling him Jesse. They started calling him Jesse, too. Their attitude was, that must be what they do when you go north. They rename your children. And so it's a reminder and an example of what can happen when people migrate, when people make this great leap of faith. And in this particular case, the case here in our country, what was at stake? What was at stake was literally the creativity, the talents, misplaced, lost forever of those who preceded, but suddenly opening up for people like Jesse Owens. It's very clear that he was not fit for the field, actually. He was fit for track and field. And he went on to win a record number of gold medals in the 1936 Olympics, the Olympics which are historic in their own right for having been hosted by the Nazis themselves. Actually, Hitler himself presided over the Olympic Games of 1936, and he went on to become a repudiation of all that they believed and ended up a proof, too, that even in this country, people such as him had not been permitted to be who they truly needed to be. Now, this migration changed our country in so many ways, created a culture that we often view as 20th century culture that actually is truly the culture of the Great Migration in many respects. So many people and so many things that we view as 20th century culture actually are the products of people who might not even have existed had there been no Great Migration. Toni Morrison, for example, the Nobel laureate, her parents were from Alabama. They migrated to Lorain, Ohio, where she was born. And by that single decision to leave, they guaranteed that their daughter would get a chance to do something that actually was against the law in Alabama at that time. She would now get the chance to go into a library and take out a library book. That was against the law in Alabama at the time she would have been growing up. They, by their singular decision, ensured that she would get access to books. And if you think about it, if you're going to become a Nobel laureate, it's a good thing to get a book now and then. When you think about theater as we know it, 20th century theater, the works of Lorraine Hansberry, someone who was the child of people who had migrated from totally different different states in the South, met in Chicago, and ultimately ran into trouble with the restrictive covenants that became part of the Northern response to the Great Migration. And their experiences became the inspiration for one of the seminal works of theater of the 20th century, A Raisin in the Sun, which in itself, the content itself, is actually a story about the Great Migration, about people who had migrated from the South to Chicago and found themselves bereft after the loss of the head of the household and wondering how now and what now shall we do to survive. August Wilson and all of the works that he created, his 10 cycle of plays, ended up being in some ways an homage to the Great Migration. Every single one of his plays is about the dislocation and the homesickness and the longing and the questions of what had been gained and what had been lost. Culture, history, family, as a result of this Great Migration. He himself was a product of the Great Migration. His grandmother actually walked from North Carolina to Pennsylvania, where his mother, her daughter ultimately met and married someone from a completely different migration stream, the stream from Germany to Pennsylvania, and thus he is one of these people who would not even have existed had there not been a migration. When it comes to music as we know it, 20th century American music, hard to imagine what we would be listening to had there been no Great Migration. Motown, for one thing, would not have existed. The founder of Motown, Berry Gordy, his parents were from Georgia, migrated to Detroit. When he got to be a grown man, he decided he wanted to go into music. He didn't have the resources to go all over the country looking for the best talent. So what did he do? He looked around himself, and there he was, surrounded by children of the Great Migration, children who were being raised in families and households in which the parents and the grandparents were listening to the music that had sustained them through all of the hardships and that they had brought to the North on their hearts and in their memories, the blues and the spirituals and the gospel music that had sustained them for generations. And the children decided they wanted to do something totally different with it, and they created a whole new sound and something totally different. And this man, Berry Gordy, saw, for example, these three girls, Mary Wilson, Florence Ballard, and a third one. I think you know her name. We wouldn't know Diana Ross's name because had there been no Great Migration, because she would not have existed. Her mother was from Alabama, father from West Virginia, migrated during totally different decades, met in Detroit, married, had her and her sister, and thus an entire new legend was born. He also heard about this very large family, this Berry Gordy, very large family, 9 or 10 children in Gary, Indiana. I think you might have an idea who I'm speaking about. There were 5 brothers in particular. The youngest one was quite the dancer and singer. We would not know, there's another example of people we would not know, the Jackson family, had there been no Great Migration, because their parents wouldn't have met. Mother was carried from Alabama to Chicago in her mother's arms as the family fled and went north. The father went from Arkansas to Chicago, where they met, married, and moved out to Gary and had all the kids. Jazz, as we know it, simply would not have existed had there been no Great Migration. Miles Davis, for example, his parents were from Arkansas, migrated to Illinois, where he had the luxury of the time that it would take to hone the talent that was within him, but which would have gone fallow in the cotton country of Arkansas. Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated from North Carolina to New York City when he was 4 years old, where his mother worked cleaning office buildings in order to save up for the used piano that she hoped he would be able to play to be able to build on a talent that she could see within him, but which would have gone fallow in the tobacco country of North Carolina. And John Coltrane. John Coltrane migrated himself. He left North Carolina for Philadelphia when he was 16. And it was not until he got to Philadelphia, that he got his first alto sax. There are many people who are aficionados of jazz who can't even imagine what the world would be like if that one man hadn't gotten hold of an alto sax. And the names that I've given you, all of these people, these are people who were gifts not just to their one genre, not just gifts to the United States, but really gifts to the world. All of these people are as revered in Tokyo and in Amsterdam and Paris as they are here in the United States. These people were gifts to the world. couple other things I want to mention, and that is one of them is that this, the beauty and inspiration of this migration, something that all of us can share in and participate in and think about and recall in our own families where in our own lineage this kind of courage was evidenced, is the fact that this migration was a leaderless revolution. There was no one who sounded the day or the hour that the people should go. It's as if something was triggered in each individual person based upon the precipitating events in their own lives and the overarching conditions in which they all were living that said, here in the land of our birth, our work is devalued and our very lives are devalued. Perhaps we will fare better elsewhere. Perhaps we will fare better if we spread ourselves out all over this land. As Professor Stauffer said earlier, when this migration began, the vast majority, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the time it was over, nearly half were living all over the rest of the country, from Alaska to Maine. They went everywhere, all corners of our country outside of the South. And in doing so, they ended up putting so much pressure on the South and the North that it forced the country to deal with something it had not dealt with before. In this way, these people ultimately were able to do what a president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, was not able to truly do. They were able to do what the Emancipation Proclamation, the sesquicentennial we just celebrated in January, they were able to do what the Emancipation Proclamation could not do. They were able to do what both houses of Congress could not or would not do. They freed themselves. They freed themselves. And what an inspiration that should be for all of us, these people had absolutely nothing. And they managed to free themselves. Nothing but a dream and a hope and a prayer that something might be better somewhere else within their own country. And I want to thank you. I want to leave you with the moment of departure. And that's the moment that occurred in the lives of the people that I've written about, but also in the lives of someone in almost all of our backgrounds, or otherwise we wouldn't be here. Someone had to make a decision to leave at some point from wherever they happened to have been. And at that moment of departure, that meant that there was going to be potentially a complete break from all that that individual might have known. Migration is something that historians have shown is something that occurs generally when people are of a certain age. They're usually teenagers, late teens, and early 20s. Our late 20s. It's something that's a young person's experience. It's something that someone does when they're on the cusp of life and they have decided that where they happen to be is not a flourishing place for them, and they decide they must try their opportunity somewhere else. And so at that moment of departure, that individual, each of the individuals, wherever they might be in our own lineages, had to have made this decision. And they ended up having to go some place where they were going to leave from. And that meant they might be at a dock about to board a ship to cross the Atlantic. Or they might have been loading up the trunk of their car to cross the Rio Grande. They might have been about to cross a ship that would take them across the Pacific Ocean. Or they might have been at a train platform about to board a train called the Silver Comet, the Silver Meteor, or whatever the train, the Southwest Chief, whatever it might have been, to get them to where they had been dreaming. And with them at that moment of departure, at that railroad platform, as they were loading up that trunk, as they were about to board that ship, were the people who had raised them. Their mother, their father, their aunt, their uncle, their grandparents, their big brothers or sisters, whomever it might have been who had gotten them to that point. And those older people were not going to be able to make the crossing with them. And so this was going to be a complete break from all that they knew and all of the people that they loved. Remember, there was no Skype, no email, no cell phones, not even reliable long-distance telephone service, and even if there had been, many of the people they were leaving didn't have telephones. This was going to be a complete break from all that they had known. And the next time that they might hear anything about the people who had raised them might be a telegram saying that their father had passed away, or that their mother was very ill, and if they were to see her alive again, they would have to get home quickly. That is the magnitude of the sacrifice that had to have occurred in almost all of our families just for us to be here. And I would hope that that would be an inspiration for all of us to make the most of this beautiful burden that they have all bequeathed to us. And I would like to close my part of this, my remarks, with the words of Richard Wright, whose words gave the book its title, and whose words are in some ways a prayer, a wish, a hope, a whisper into the hearts and minds of all of us, depending upon where our challenges may be, telling us that there is hope and there is a way for us to get to that other side of wherever it is we're trying to get. He wrote these words as he was contemplating his own moment of departure in 1927 from Mississippi through Memphis and on to a place called Chicago. And he wrote these words, "I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps, just perhaps, to bloom." Thank you so much for having me.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Isabel, that was just a beautiful, terrific talk. And hearing you speak and hearing you read from your book just highlighted to me how brilliant you are as a writer. As I conveyed or suggested in my introduction, one of the great writers in American literary history. And so my first question is, when did you know that you wanted to become a writer, and who were some of the influences that you really latched on to that helped you to develop your art?
Thank you for asking. I was one of those people, one of those children who had the flashlight under the blanket. So I always have been drawn to the written word. It was the one thing that I could find solace in, actually. I wrote all these stories that I, as a child, that I wouldn't dare let anyone see. I spent a tremendous amount of time hiding them because I was so afraid of what someone might think. And then I remember hearing that you actually could make a living as a writer. You could write for newspapers. How awesome is that? And so that was the path that I took in order to begin living out the life of a writer. And, you know, throughout my experiences of writing, I've been inspired by the works of Eudora Welty. I just feel such a deep and abiding connection to her. I believe that she manages to really deconstruct the many layers of caste and class and the nuances of what it means to be in this powder keg of a place, mm-hmm. and still attempt to maintain dignity in that. The relationships that she describes. One of my favorite works of hers is The Optimist's Daughter. I just feel such a strong connection to that. Of course, you know, we all have to say Faulkner. We all have to say Hemingway. Of course, we are inspired by all of them. When it comes to people outside of this country, José Saramago, I'm one of these people who loved blindness. I just loved... I love the any kind of work that gets at the many complexities good and bad. And in fact, that there is no such thing as the perfect person, clearly. And there's no such thing as the perfect villain either. That we're all such complex creatures. And I think that he captures the range of difficulty of what it means to be human. Toni Morrison, of course. I mean, all of the usual people that you might expect have been such tremendous influences on me.
Now, before you started writing The Warmth of Other Suns, you were a journalist for The New York Times. You were the first African-American woman to win a Pulitzer Prize anywhere, and this was for feature writing. And this is a question about staying or leaving. So you were highly acclaimed, one of the most highly acclaimed journalists for arguably one of the most prestigious newspapers in the country. And you quit. You quit your job to write a book that takes 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
15 years.
Yeah.
And you end up living with your mother, a former migrant herself.
Yeah.
So what was you mentioned the trigger for these. What was the trigger for you? And how did you, what gave you the kind of courage, and it's truly courage necessary to make that step?
Well, there's so many ways to answer that. One of them is, I think, that being a child of people who did this, you know, without saying what they did, they didn't talk about their experiences. I was surrounded in Washington, D.C., which is where my parents migrated from. My mother was from Rome, Georgia. And my father was from Petersburg, Virginia, near the North Carolina border. And they had both migrated during different decades, and they never spoke about what they had endured, what they'd been through. It's almost as if in this migration and in many other migrations, the moment of arrival was almost a new birth date for themselves. And they put everything behind them, and they didn't talk of what they'd endured. They didn't want to burden anyone else with all that they had experienced. And so I had this desire to know. So there was this always wanting to know. I was surrounded by people who were part of the migration, but no one talked of it in the ways that you might think now, that we're more commonly aware of it. No one spoke of it in such a way as to say, well, remember that year during the Great Migration? Remember when the migration was on? There was no language for that. It wasn't referred to in that way. And yet it was everywhere. Everyone was living the world. In fact, they created colonies of people. Every single person that I interacted with growing up in the neighborhood that I grew up in, we're all from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, but no one spoke of it. And so becoming a journalist made me even more aware of how widespread this was. It wasn't just Washington. It wasn't just New York where I was working. I went out and did stories in Los Angeles. I did stories in, obviously, I became Chicago bureau chief. And everywhere I went, there were specific connections between some particular place in the South whenever I happened to be interviewing people who are African American. And so all of that began to gel. In addition, there were several things that, pieces in American culture that became prominent at that time. One was a sleeper of a movie by Barry Levinson called Avalon. I don't know if you are familiar with that. I think it's a wonderful film. Mm-hmm. The film is actually about a person who immigrates from an unnamed Eastern European country to Baltimore, which is very close to Washington, D.C., where I'm from. And he has difficulty, all the challenges of any immigrant, making an adjustment in the new world. He becomes successful, and his children feel a disconnect because they're being raised as Americans. They don't really know all that he'd been through, and again, he himself was not really talking very much about all he endured. And I felt that you could change the city to Washington and change the neighborhood to the one that I grew up in Washington, D.C., and change this unnamed European country to some unnamed southern state, and you'd have the same story. Very similar, and I felt such an inspiration. I felt such a connection to that. In fact, a greater connection to that than I have done felt to many films that are putatively actually about African Americans. Mm-hmm. I also felt a connection to the book The Joy Luck Club, which was mm-hmm. about women who migrate from China to the United States, and they too confront the challenges of raising daughters that they hope will maintain the values of the old world while succeeding in a new fast place that doesn't really often respect or adhere to the old ways of doing things. And so I felt such a complete and total connection to that. And all of those things were happening in the early to mid 90s, around the time that I began to think about working on this book. And I felt all these things came together, and I decided to do what I guess runs through the veins of so many people who have are children of migration. In fact, it would be my argument that one of the reasons that the United States is one of the great innovators in the world as it has been is because, in large part, it's a country of immigrants. Mm-hmm. It's a country of people who took this great leap of faith. This great leap of faith into the unknown, natural adventurers, natural risk takers who are willing to say, we're going to go for it and see what happens and hope for the best. And I think there's a connection there.
That's great. And how did you land on, how did you find your amazing protagonists? So you have these three truly extraordinary protagonists. I've read the book twice, and both times, it's truly hard to put down. You want to follow the protagonist, and then your inner chapters, you know, you realize how the that they universalize your people. How did you find your three protagonists? You interviewed over 2,000 people, 1,200
yeah.
people. Where did you find them? How did you land on these three protagonists as the ones to be the spine, so to speak, of your story?
Well, I made a critical decision that also was a leap of faith, and that was I felt this great urgency to go for the people first and hope that the archives would be there for me to explore once I had done that. So there would be an argument, you might say, you could another way to do it would be to do all the research so you know exactly what you're looking for after you've researched the archives, and then you go look for the people who would ultimately be your protagonists or your sources. And in this particular case, I decided to do the opposite. And I did it because these people were getting up in years, and migration began in World War I. It ended in essentially 1970, but to get to the oldest people, I needed to work fast. So this was a great race against the clock. So I went for the people first. And I really, truly found that in some ways that was a tutorial interviewing those 1,200 people. So where did I go? I went to every place that I could think of that senior citizens would be in the North, in these northern cities. I went to Baptist churches in New York. There are actually Baptist churches in New York where everybody's from South Carolina. There are Catholic churches in Los Angeles where everybody's from New Orleans. There are multiple Mississippi clubs in Chicago. There's a Greenwood Mississippi Club, a Greenville Mississippi Club, a Grenada Mississippi Club, a Newton Mississippi Club, a Brookhaven Mississippi Club, and I went to all those different clubs, and you had to go to all the different clubs because if you were from Brookhaven, you didn't go to the Grenada Club. So in order to get all those people, I had to go to each of the clubs because there was no interaction between these clubs, because if you were from Grenada, why would you go to the Greenwood Club? And so I did all that, and I went to all these different places, and I did not find any of these people, the three, in any of those places. But I would not change a thing because this was part of the tutorial that was necessary for me to truly understand what were the similarities, what were the differences, what were the themes that I would hear over and over again from the people that I interviewed. So it was extremely helpful. And all of those things led me ultimately to the people that I found. So then I started to go even further, and I went to the retirees pensioners clubs for all the different things, postal workers and transit workers and all that. And that is where I found, for example, Ida Mae's daughter. Not Ida Mae herself, but her daughter was there at one of those. That's when I found her. And for Dr. Foster, I actually spent so much time in Los Angeles that people began to recognize me from the different places. I went to Juneteenth parades. I had a booth at the Juneteenth parade. I went to the Leimert Park, for those of you from Los Angeles. I went to the Leimert Park Festival. I went to all these different places. I went to multiple Creole clubs and the churches, every place that I could think of, and various alumni clubs for the black colleges from in the South. Anyway, I went to all these different places, and at one of the places, I was interviewing all these people and hearing wonderful stories, but I had not felt I'd found just the right combination to match these three. It's a combination of the three that I think helps the reader see the different sides of this migration.
So you knew early on that you wanted to focus on the three migrations that reflected the African Americans from the Southwest going up to the West, from the Alabama and Mississippi going up to the Midwest, and from the Southeast going up to New York and Boston.
Yes, that's it exactly. I knew that there were going to be three protagonists. Mm-hmm. I was looking for one in each of these three cities, and it was just a matter of going to all these different places in order to find them. And for Dr. Foster, it's kind of interesting. I went to so many places there that a woman actually came up to me and she said, "You know, I've seen you at all of these different events. I've seen you at St. Bernadette's Senior Center. I've seen you at St. Bridget's Church. I've seen you at the Jefferson Council. These are all the different organizations that I went to, and it was a great effort, as you can imagine, because I wasn't living in Los Angeles at the time. And so she had seen me. She said, "I've seen you at these different places, and I've heard the questions that you've asked the people, and I've heard the answers you've been getting." And she said, "You know, I think I know the perfect person for you." And I just thought, there is no way you could know the perfect person. I don't even know the perfect person for me. And she said, no, I'm gonna give you his name. His name is Dr. Foster. And I think you should talk with him." Now, he didn't go to any of these events, so therefore I wouldn't have known him otherwise. So none of this was a waste of time. All of this was leading me ultimately to them, but it just wasn't as direct as I would have liked.
Right. Now, were there other protagonists that you were considering, other people who were contenders for your three main ones that
yes.
ended up falling out, and why?
And it's interesting that there were people who did fall away, and I'd spent a tremendous amount of time with them. I spent a lot of time with people. Mm-hmm. There was one man who had hoboed from essentially hopped a train with some of his friends to get from Louisiana to California, and they went in the wrong direction. In one case, they ended up in Mexico, but that's a long story. You know, the freight train doesn't tell you where it's going. There's no sign. They don't really actually want you on there. And so I heard lots of stories that way. And in fact, many of the runners-up do appear in the book. They make cameo appearances in the book. Yeah.
And how did you, as I emphasized, the great accomplishments of the book is the way you structure it. I mean, the title itself conveys the fact that this is an epic. And in all epics, whether it's Grapes of Wrath or Moby Dick or the epic of civil rights, American the King years, structuring it so that the reader will continue to want to keep moving forward is crucial. When and how did you land on that, on the structure for your book?
Well, I really appreciate that question, because the beauty of that question is that I rarely get it, which means that hopefully it means that it may be working, because hopefully you don't want to have people thinking about that. You want people to just, you want the reader to just fall under the spell of the words. And so I so appreciate that question. A great deal of time and effort went into it. I knew that the Siebold book, The Emigrants, I love that book, and I studied that book along with The Grapes of Wrath and so many other things related to the migration, any kind of migration story. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I did not want to have them in full blocks. I didn't want all of Ida May in one block, and then all of George in one block, and then all of Robert in another block. I felt that their stories went on for many decades, and I didn't want people to go through that experience all the way through. I also wanted people to recognize, I really believe that they are one person. They are all sides of one entity, and that is the person who is decided they must go. Mm-hmm. And they all become one, in my view. And so I wanted us to be able to always keep in mind, it's not just this one. Mm-hmm. There's also this one, and there's also this one. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I wanted was I wanted to be able to make the distinction that when you're following them, and it got very complicated because they didn't all leave at the same time. They left in different decades. In fact, that was one thing I wanted. Ida May leaves in 1930s. George leaves in the 1940s. and Dr. Foster leaves in 1950s. And that was something I was looking for in pulling them together. I wanted you to be able to see, I wanted to show, not tell you, that this went on for a very long time. And by having them leave at different times, different decades, that would show it to the reader as opposed to telling. But that made it really complicated because they were all doing different things during different decades or different years in different places. And so that's the reason why the structure is tremendously complicated. And so what I sought to do was to have the reader with them emotionally at the point in their lives where they were doing whatever it was that was necessary to take them on this journey. So you meet them all at childhood, but they're different years. For Ida Mae, she was older then, so her childhood came a little bit before the others. And you meet them as they're courting. In those days, you didn't date, you courted, and they're all courting at the same time at the, in the trajectory of the narrative. And you meet them as they're all experiencing the pressures that are going to force them to make this singular decision. And you're with them emotionally. And I thought that was more important than the dates and the places, because ultimately you could read past that. What you couldn't read past was how they were feeling. Because the goal was for all of us to imagine ourselves as these people, to be able to see ourselves in these people and to ask ourselves, what would we have done? What would we have done? And that's what I wanted people to experience.
And that is so truly, truly brilliantly done. It really is one of the many ways in which this book is so extraordinarily powerful. So that's a wonderful answer. At the end of your book, you briefly mentioned the reverse migration of African Americans returning to the South. Since your book was published, the 2010 census highlights that reverse migration is accelerating, reflecting a desire to flee what sociologists now call the hyper-segregation of northern cities and for better jobs in the South. And as you point out, the disproportionate number of these reverse migrants move into the suburbs. They're professionals. They move to the suburbs. They send their children to suburban schools and essentially integrate them. How do you understand that reverse migration in relation to the migration? And because you're the foremost authority on the migration from an experiential felt experience, where do you see it going over the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I have many reactions to this. I call it a return migration because I have the greatest respect for anyone who migrates. I mean, spending so much time on it, being a daughter of people who did this. Actually, I'm one of these people who would not even exist had there been no great migration, because my parents wouldn't have met. They were from different parts of the South and came during different years, so I owe my very existence to it, as most Americans do when you think about your lineage. But in any case, what I call return migration is something that began in around 1970, mid-70s, and in many respects, it's an indication of the sort of mission accomplished with the Great Migration itself, because the South began to make real progress in changing. That did not mean that it's where it needs to be. It doesn't mean that the country is where it needs to be. But because there were recognizable, real changes that occurred, fitfully, of course, because there was resistance to the civil rights legislation of the 1960s and remains to this day, even so. But for the most part, change occurred to such a degree that people did not feel the need to leave in order to be the people that they felt they were inside. And therefore, the return migration is in some ways one of the legacies of the Great Migration itself. Mm. I view the Great Migration as a singular moment in history that is distinct from any singular demographic shift that we might see in other aspects of our history. In other words, this was in some ways the after effect of the lost, the missed promises, the lost promises of the Emancipation Proclamation, of the broken promises that occurred after Reconstruction. History, I've come to realize and respect, and as I know you know so much better than I, takes a long time. It's a long arc for all these things to occur. We often want to think of things as happening in a decade or happening in this particular generation, but this is a slow-moving thing. And we're talking about the sesquicentennial right now, the Civil War. We're still living with the after effects of it. And this great migration was the ultimate emancipation for people who had been held down in a caste system literally as the serfs of the land into which their ancestors had helped build, and that there was no way for them to move out of that serfdom but to leave. Once they left, it put so much pressure on the country to change that the after effect meant that finally the emancipation that should have happened in 1863 did not happen until after this migration had occurred. And so I don't see any movements that people make now are now a part of what it means to be mainstream American. Many of these people who are leaving inner city Detroit, inner city Chicago, other major cities are moving to further places. There are people who are, there's a migration now going on from Chicago to Iowa, for example. There are migrations to the suburbs of Chicago, and there are migrations to the big cities of the South, to up to Houston, to Atlanta, to Charlotte. And so all of these are, in some ways, the legacies of the major cataclysmic watershed moment in our history, which was called the Great Migration.
That's great. You've pointed out, and I have too, that if the Civil War was about the status of African Americans, as everyone at the time understood, then to fully appreciate your book, you have to understand that ultimately the South won the war, which is what these migrants are responding to, and is still responding to. Did you understand when you were writing this that essentially your book would appropriately coincide with the 150th anniversary of the Civil War? That it, in a sense, is part of the Civil War?
You know, I just wanted to finish the book. I just really wanted to finish the book. But, you know, I think that, you know, in this very spiritual, sacred space, there are no... I think this is a place where it could be truly understood that there are no coincidences, and it came out when it needed to come out.
So I want to end by having you read another passage, because hearing you read when you were speaking and I was in the audience, there's truly a music to your prose, and what better way to end this conversation than to hear some more music?
I think so. That's so perfect, and I am going to read Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, who 60 years ago, at this very time, had been making his way across this land of the West and en route to California, and this is the day that I met him. Los Angeles, 1996. The paneled door rises a story high and would befit a museum or government office, but is actually the front door of a Spanish revival south of Wilshire. The door opens, and there stands a one-time bourbon-swilling army captain and deft-handed surgeon who, now in his later years, is a regular at the blackjack tables and the trifectas at Santa Anita. But he is, at the heart of it all, and perhaps most important, a long-standing, still bitter, and somewhat obsessive expatriate from the 20th century South, the heartbreak Jim Crow land he chose to reject before it could reject him again. He is a Californian now, this Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. He is the color of strong coffee and has waves in his hair, which he lets grow as untamed as Einstein's, but then brushes back like the boys in the band. He's wearing a white cotton island shirt, loose slacks and sandals, the uniform of a well-to-do L.A. pensioner. He has the build and bearing of a Sammy Davis Jr. and not a little of the showmanship and delightful superficiality that seem to grow on people in certain circles of L.A. I should interject and say that I've read that in L.A. and they loved it. I thought as I read it I should have taken that out, but they actually loved that. I said, that's right. He walked straight back and slew-footed into the foyer, past the curved faux gone-with-the-wind staircase and the East Asian pottery. He gestures toward the living room, an imposing ballroom of a space that dwarfs him in its volume, fairly frozen in the seafoam carpet and hot pink tulip chairs out of a sherbety Doris Day movie from the 50s. The whole effect is as starched and formal as the tuxedos he used to wear to the parties he threw for himself back when his wife Alice was alive and the money was raining down like confetti. He seems accustomed to people fawning over the place, and with the prim air of leading man of his favorite movies from back in the 40s, insists on serving his guests a slice of lemon pound cake and vanilla ice cream on Rosenthal china, whether they would like to have it or not. He is a physician, or was for most of his adult life, and by most accounts, a very good one, and is prone to pontificate like a man of his years and accomplishments. But he is just as likely to interrupt himself and check the time to see if he can still make the 1 o'clock at the Hollywood Park racetrack. His photo albums are filled with an unlikely assortment of bookies and blues singers and dentists and fraternity men and surgeons and society people whose approval he craved, even though he knew they were too pretentious to matter, really. He doesn't say it because it would be gauche and hardly worth mentioning from his point of view, but there happen to be a lot of little Roberts around town due to the fact that over the years he delivered a number of baby boys whose mothers were so grateful for his firm hand and calming reassurances at the precise moment of truth that they named their sons not after their husbands, but after the doctor who had delivered their babies. Before he begins a story, he tells you it's a long one and you can't get it all. He's lived too many lives, done too much, known too many people, ridden so high and so low that there's no point in fooling yourself into thinking you can capture the whole of it. You could try, of course, and he agrees to give as much as he can. "I love to talk," he says, a smile forming on his still chiseled face as he sits upright in his tulip chair. "And I am my favorite subject."
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.